Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey everyone, hello, it is Kitty Martone, Healthy Gut Girl, coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And I have been so incredibly busy. I know everyone's busy, right? And I haven't been able to podcast lately. I've just been doing so many different things. My business, Ona's, is growing so fast, and it has me, I'm telling you, juggling plates. And I also am redoing my website. And I've also decided to kind of funnel all of my services that I offer, like my progesterone guidance and my gut health and hormone, my gut health programs and the Dutch program, the hormone program, all into one service. So now I'm basically offering what's called the Gut and Hormone Rehab Program. So I'm no longer going to sell the Dutch. All right. If you want the Dutch complete, you have to go through Precision Analytical to get it. And I do offer a coupon code, which is MDW100. And that's $100 off of what they charge for the Dutch. Okay. And so you can go into the show notes, and the link for Precision Analytical is there for you to purchase the Dutch and use your coupon code. Once you get your results, you can then book an appointment with me, and I will review your results, and I'll give you a very in-depth, comprehensive interpretation, as well as recommendations for detoxification if needed, for supplementation if needed, for bioidentical hormone therapy guidance if needed, and also for some general dietary guidelines. If you don't have to have any labs in order to book this appointment, you can just come to me with your new client form, which you will fill out upon booking. You can come to me with that. And then I can create a program for you based on that information, which can be really effective and get you pretty far. You don't always need labs, but it is encouraged. So that's what I'm doing now. And it's not that much more than if you would have booked straight through me the actual Dutch test. It's $50 more doing it this way. But what it does is it cuts me out as the middleman. So if you have questions about shipping, or I forgot I ate avocado on the wrong day and I took it, or I had coffee and I know I shouldn't have, what should I do? Or I skipped one of my samples. Or if you have any of those questions, that's not my expertise. That's the company's area of expertise. So you can go straight to them with those questions. So it cuts me out with having to process your order. You know, sometimes people put the wrong address and then it gets lost, and I'm the one that has to deal with that. I do not have time to do that stuff any longer. So we cut out the middleman, and now you're going straight to Precision Analytical to get your Dutch, and then you're booking with me. Another thing is, I am not going to give live phone consults or live Zoom conferences. This is all online correspondence for a bunch of different reasons. One of the reasons is because I have a very difficult time with boundaries and clients as far as time goes. Appointments are meant to be an hour. I end up talking for 2-3. Ask some of my old clients. They're like, we were on the phone for half a day. I can't do that. First of all, it's just very exhausting for me. It's very taxing on my voice. And I have to podcast several times a week. And it's not possible for me anymore. It's exhausting. And when I do a consult with people live, they have so many questions after the consultation. So then I am then burdened with having to go back and show them where we discussed this or that. When it's online and in written out form, there is a thread of conversation between the two of us that you can then access. You can go back and look at something, or I can answer it in writing, and there it is for you forever to look at. Should you ever have issues come up again, you can always reference it and go back to it and say, oh, that's right. She said my cortisol was high, and that's why we're not taking this, or that's why we're doing that. And it's just so much more helpful. It cuts down on so many questions. And those are the main reasons why I've done that. And it allows me to help more people in that way. So when you book your appointment, you're not booking an actual date. It's going to ask you, what date do you want to book? That is insignificant. You could pick 200 years from now. It's not going to matter. Or you could pick today. It's not going to matter. Just take whatever is open, because it doesn't matter. What's going to happen is it's going to notify me that you've booked an appointment, and then I'm going to send you your new client form. I'm going to ask you to attach your Dutch results or any lab results that you might want to share with me. And that's it. And then I'm going to do your program. It's going to take me about a week, and then you're going to have your program emailed to you. And I'm going to correspond with you for another 3 weeks after you receive that to answer any other questions or whatever. Does that make sense? I hope it does, because that's how it's going to work from now on. That's how it's going to be, friends. And I have a lot of testimonials that are going up on the website, so you can read through how everyone has been doing with this method. I've been doing it for many years now, ever since I started losing my voice from talking way too much. Okay, so today we have on Constantine, and he's going to join me right now. I'm literally going to let him into this Zoom conversation right this very minute. So let's welcome back. And we're going to do a smorgasbord. I like to call it a blue plate special of talking about whatever comes to mind. So what I actually already started, I was recording before I let you in and talking about a bunch of different things. One of the things was, and I wanted to chat with you about, because we haven't really talked about it, you and I, which is that month I took off of supplementation, where I just stopped taking supplements. And then in order to take all of the hormone labs that I participated in recently, I also stopped doing hormones so I could take all of the different labs that I took, the hormone labs. And I'm just now getting everything back. Some things are taking longer than others. And I thought we would talk about interesting things that have happened. And being at the last week right now of my 16-week accelerator program with Kitty Bloomfield.
Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, I've always been more of the fan of taking 2 weeks off of progesterone every week, every month for a woman. Like, that's always just been my opinion of like the best thing to do, based on what Ray Pita said and Georgie. And I know different people might need daily and stuff, but I've always thought it would be the best to at least do 1 week off a month. So I'm happy that just even stopping all supplements and hormones, you know, you can experience just like an actual time period away from progesterone. And maybe you'll find that you like to take 1-2 week off every month, or maybe you'll like taking it daily. I don't know, but I'm still on the camp of it's good to take breaks on a monthly basis.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would wholeheartedly agree with that, because I think that the body takes breaks, right? We have cycles, but I think I'm kind of lucky because I'm in menopause most likely. And that is, I'm not in such demand of high hormones anymore. Whereas if you would have told me to take a 2 week break 3 years ago, I would have probably bled to death in between taking in that 2 week interim. I would have had some pretty major problems. Maybe not 3 years ago, but when I started taking progesterone and I hadn't dealt with all of my metabolic issues, getting off of progesterone for one day, I would have started bleeding, and then all kinds of other symptoms would have started. So, you know, that's the problem with breaking for some women.
You know, that kind of leads me to something I wanted to talk about. So about things that aren't intuitively a result of a low energy state, but are, at least partly a result of low energy production. And, you know, that can be low metabolic rate, low thyroid. There's all these different names, but low energy state would be the general kind of catch-all term. And, you know, in my Substack, I've written ADHD. I've called ADHD a paradoxically low energy state. Soon, by the time this is out, the insomnia article will be out, and insomnia is also, I called it a paradoxically low energy state. But there's many things that are also, I would call, a paradoxically low energy state. And one of them is, so you just mentioned that, you know, years ago, you would have definitely needed progesterone every day. And I think that's a perfect example of an issue that is probably at the heart of it, a low energy situation, and increasing the energy production probably would have really helped there. And my reasoning is, with things like needing progesterone production to be, you know, to feel normal and to not have all these issues with bleeding and all that, you need enough energy for the corpus luteum to even make the progesterone, to release it. And you need a lot of things, right? Everyone talks about, rightfully so, you need enough vitamin A consumption and things like that. And that's true, but you need energy production. You need good metabolic rate, thyroid hormone levels and all that. So increasing the energy production, and there's lots of ways to do that, but at the very simplistic way of looking at it, it's having adequate metabolic rate, which includes thyroid hormones and, you know, ATP production, all that. Without that base level, that good level of energy production, you'll come across all sorts of issues. And, you know, it could be symptoms of a named condition, like an ADHD, or it could just be, you know, something that's not a named condition, like, oh, you're more irritable than normal, or you're more susceptible to issues that require you to use something like progesterone daily. But if, you know, if someone's like you right now, if someone's like that right now, where they need progesterone daily, maybe fixing the energetic state, producing more energy, will allow them to actually make enough progesterone and retain the things that the progesterone is helping them retain, so they won't need to take it daily. I guess that's the long way of saying there's a lot of issues and symptoms that are a result of not producing enough energy.
Right. So when you say paradoxical low energy state, explain what you mean by that. Why don't you just say low energy state?
Yeah. So it's more paradoxical for things like for like ADHD and insomnia, because the argument is it's paradoxical because most people would see an ADHD child. So let's say he's hyperactive, right? He's hyperactive, he's bouncing off the walls, or he's interrupting the teacher all the time, or he won't listen to his mom and he's running around. So, you know, he seems like he has a lot of energy. But at least according to, you know, what I think, a major driver of hyperactivity in children or just general ADHD would be that they're not producing enough energy. So it's a low energy state is making them hyperactive, which is, you know, most people, every time I hear people colloquially talking about ADHD and hyperactive children in general, it's called, oh, they have too much energy, or oh, they need to run outside to like release energy, like as if they have energy that's brimming from the tank and they need to kind of deplete it so they can like focus on class or whatever. But, and even with the non-hyperactive part of ADHD, a lot of ADHD is, you know, inability to, you might not be hyperactive, but you might be doing, you're a student, you might not be doing well in school because maybe it's difficult for that child to hold attention, to concentrate, to comprehend what's going on in the class and things like that. So they might not be bouncing up and down, but, you know, they're not able to pay attention. So even that, someone might say, oh, their mind is racing and looking all over the place and stuff, but it's not because they have too much energy production. It's because they don't have enough energy production. So like the very general argument is it takes energy, a lot of energy, an abundance of energy, to be able to sit still, focus, concentrate, learn. And similarly, it takes an abundance of energy to relax and to sleep. So that's why I call ADHD a paradoxically low energy state, insomnia a paradoxically low energy state. That's the titles, the two titles of the two separate articles on my website, because I think it's a very fitting title for both of these conditions, because you would assume these people have too much energy. That's why you can't sleep. You have too much energy. Well, it takes a lot of energy for the body to be able to relax, shut down, and say, I'm going to sleep for the 6 to 8 hours, whatever. Same with ADHD. So the idea is, and there's lots of reasons for this. Obviously, the general idea is it takes energy to sit still, focus, relax, fine. But further to that, a lot of ADHD and even insomnia people and researchers have noted that, well, part of it might be they have a lot of stress hormones, a lot of catecholamines, you know, it's adrenaline, noradrenaline, even dopamine's catecholamine, right? They might have a lot of these cortisol and things that are kind of amping them up, which could lead to trouble sleeping, could lead to hyperactivity, right? So insomnia and ADHD have a lot of similar, at least causes, but also attributes in some sense. Well, if you think about it, if you're not producing, and so these stress hormones aren't energy. By having high stress hormones, you're not at a high energy state, you're at a low energy state, because if you're not producing enough energy, like for example, you're not adequately, effectively taking glucose and oxidizing it to make all the things that happen. So, you know, ATP, obviously, which is energy, but also carbon dioxide and water and heat. There's a lot of things that happen with energy production, but if we're talking about energy as in terms of a unit, let's ATP, right? So if you're not taking glucose and you're oxidizing it, making this ATP, this energy, if you don't have enough thyroid hormone production, or probably more relevant, you're not converting the inactive to the active thyroid hormone, so T4 to T3 effectively enough. These are just two examples of situations which would lead you to not be producing enough energy if you're having trouble with these energy producing processes. So if you're not producing enough energy that way, your body has to compensate, and it usually overcompensates, especially the longer you're dealing with this low energy state. So this low thyroid state, low liver state, and I say liver primarily because your thyroid gland produces a lot of T4, but that needs to be activated to be useful. And the liver is a major place where that happens, but also the kidney and other places, but the liver is a main place. So that's why I kind of say, and this is relevant in the PCOS article too, because PCOS is a very similar situation. But I'll just finish by saying, if you're having trouble with energy production, so your thyroid and liver are low, and you're not oxidizing glucose well because of lots of different things, well, your body will compensate because of this low energy by giving you a bunch of stress. So a lot of cortisol production, a lot of adrenaline production, noradrenaline, aldosterone, all types of hormones that are, I guess you would say, backup secondary hormones. Stress hormones in general, they're increased because of they need to compensate for the low thyroid. And one example is, you know, Ray Pete would often talk about or mention that one specific stress hormone that increases is if your thyroid hormone is really downregulated for a long time, you slowly increase your baseline adrenaline production. And he says it can get up to 40 times the amount it should be. And just a quick tangent, that's part of the reason he said that sometimes if someone starts to take thyroid hormone, like as a supplement or medication, he says that they can feel a lot of adrenaline, because when you're in a low thyroid state, even 40 times the amount of adrenaline that's normal won't feel that crazy. But once you take thyroid, his argument was, now you're, since your body has enough thyroid hormone because you're taking it in this example, in this situation, then you will feel the adrenaline, because before you're not really feeling it, you're desensitized because you're producing so much. So he said a lot of people can have these huge stress reactions to taking T3, because now they take T3, they can feel the adrenaline they have, and they have 40 times the amount of adrenaline they should have, as an example. So they you know, start freaking out, kind of thing. And that's just a great example to show that the longer you've been in a low energy state, the more the body will try to increase, quote unquote energy, not ATP, but like, you know, the feel of energy via these stress hormones, and they'll just get worse and worse and worse. And that's one of the main reasons why, oh, ADHD, the kid's hyperactive, he must have low energy. He must have high energy. No, he has low energy. Same with insomnia. The story goes far deeper, but that's the general argument for why it's paradoxical.
One of my questions, and I don't want you to answer this yet, is how then is a person supposed to know? Like, I'm the perfect person that you should be talking to about this, because I grew up Let her run outside, stick her in the swimming pool, put her in the garage and turn the radio on. She'll dance until she falls over. Like, just let her burn off her energy. And it was never energy. And then, you know, you get to bed, you're staring at the walls. I was a kid. I couldn't fall asleep for hours. When I finally would fall asleep, I'd be in a coma. And then I'd wake up, be impossible to get me out of bed, go to school, have a little bit of energy, and then have a meal. And then I was asleep on my desk, and then it'd start all over again. The rest of the day, I'd be super hyper. So now I'm starting to realize that, okay, I can recognize when I'm adrenalized and when I'm just clean energy. And a quick example was I was at church yesterday and I just really felt like having coffee and donuts because it was church and I just felt like it. But I did wake up and I made some gluten-free pancakes. So there I had carbs, some eggs in them, went to church with my husband, had a whole cup of coffee, which I rarely do, and it was caffeinated, and I had like four donut holes. And I felt great. It was awesome. Church started. I could not sit still. Could not sit still. Was sweating. My palms were sweating. I was like, oh my God, this is awful. We actually left early. And I just said, I can't. And my whole day was ruined. And I can't do this to myself. You know, I put myself in this adrenalized state thinking I have so much energy. One of the differences between knowing if you have adrenaline or energy is, can you sit down? Can you focus on something? If you're up in the middle of the night, get up, go in the other room if you're with a partner and you don't want to wake them up, turn the light on, try to read a book, try to sit down and get on the computer and work. Chances are you can't do that because you're like, I should be sleeping. I should be awake. I should be sleeping because you're so adrenalized that you can't, that's not an energy, right? So here's the part that blew my mind. You just said people who take thyroid might have this revelation of, oh my God, I have 40 times more adrenaline than I can. And then I realize, and they're like, they can't, and they feel like something's completely wrong now. And their doctor has given them the wrong advice. Well, you've also said in the past that progesterone can upregulate thyroid hormone production in some people. Yeah. Well, what about, and this happened to me, someone who's been running on adrenaline their whole lives and is even has panic and anxiety disorder. You start taking progesterone for the first time, and all of a sudden, I was almost psychotic. For at least 10 days, I was going in and out of panic attacks that I have never experienced. I grew up with panic attacks and anxiety. These were like psychosis. And I was so scared. And if I hadn't been at the end of my rope with my hormones and my situation, I would have quit progesterone. But I was listening to the experts. I was reading about, you have to surpass those points so that you can get used to it. Now, what you're proposing, and is this true? Could the progesterone have also been upregulating my thyroid? My body was like, oh my God, I've got 40 times more adrenaline than I realize. It's making me psychotic and crazy and have these crazy panic attacks. And then I surpassed that dosing, that low dosing, and was able to normalize to everything. And I was able to manage and handle it. And of course, now, 10 years later, practically, I'm like, oh, I know the difference between adrenalized and energized. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's plausible. I think you kind of started with a premise and went through your whole argument, and I agree on every point. I think it's all plausible. Another thing I thought of is just because Ray, in so many of his books, Ray Pete, in so many of his books, mentioned that taking progesterone is really awesome because it'll tell your body to produce more, which is, you know, people say, oh, you know, hormones are bad to take because if a man takes testosterone, he won't produce any more, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Negative feedback. But Ray was, you know, a big point of his was progesterone is such a unique hormone, such a great hormone to take, because when you take it, instead of, you know, decreasing your own production, you are increasing your own production. You're signaling the body to make more. And he said pregnenolone is likely the same. But he goes, I think one of the quotes he even says, pregnenolone is likely the same, but the evidence is nowhere near as clear as progesterone, or something along those lines. So, like, he was saying the evidence shows for sure progesterone supplementation in a woman will make her make more. I'm thinking if you're taking all this progesterone and your body's like, okay, ovaries, it's time to make more. It is a stressful, energy intensive, right, process to make progesterone. And your body could have been trying really hard to make progesterone in the ovaries and things like that. But maybe you didn't have enough energy production. You weren't using glucose well, right? And that's an
I
article
wasn't
you were
eating
reading.
enough.
Yeah, you weren't eating enough. So you didn't have enough things that you need to use the glucose well. You weren't giving yourself actual, so nutrition, yes, but also just, energy containing foods too. So you can't, you didn't have the actual calories, I guess would be one way to say it. And maybe you didn't have enough thyroid hormone levels at that point to actually take the cholesterol you had and help convert it into the hormones, pregnenolone, progesterone. So you could have been stressing your body out because your body's trying really hard to do a really hard thing, but you just couldn't do it. And this is really relevant to like for PMS, for example. A lot of people feel really bad in the luteal phase. In the luteal phase, the phase before the period starts, right, the bleed starts, is the period where you're supposed to be producing the most progesterone. And a lot of people, incorrectly in my opinion, say, oh, progesterone is what causes PMS because PMS is when progesterone is highest. But I would
Right.
phrase that and I would say, no, PMS is when progesterone need is highest. So if progesterone need is highest right before the period, so the premenstrual phase, right, the luteal phase, and you're not producing enough. So let's say, random numbers with no units. Let's say a woman needs 10 progesterone, right, random, and she could only in the luteal phase, and she can only produce physically only produce 4. She'll feel terrible for a bunch of reasons. One of the reasons is she doesn't have enough progesterone, so she's 10 minus 4, she's 6 away from being at the level she needs. But if her body's only producing a small amount of progesterone related to what she needs, so in this situation, 4 when she needs 10, the body's not just stopping at 4, it's trying to produce 10, but it's not. It's trying to produce as much as you're supposed to, but if you're not at that level, you have the dual negative of not having enough progesterone, but also having the extreme stress of your body trying in all of its might to make the progesterone. But it all comes back to a low energy state because if you're not producing enough energy, you can't do energy intensive things well, like producing progesterone during the luteal phase. So that's a PMS. There's a lot that goes in with PMS, right? There's mood symptoms, there's the physical symptoms, right? Cramps versus, mood swings. There's a lot to the story of PMS, and people can find out, what I've written about that. My website, I have an article, PMS common, not inevitable. But the point I want to make right now is trying to produce progesterone when you can be a really stressful thing. So part of why you felt bad when you were taking progesterone might be because your body was like, okay, it's time to make progesterone now, and they just couldn't. That's like the end of that thought. But that's not to say that didn't also happen, or maybe what you proposed is the main reason why you were feeling the way you felt. Both of these are just ideas, but yeah, it goes back to not being able to produce enough energy.
I think that's important because it really resonates with a lot of women who start progesterone and get anxiety right away. They take progesterone and they have anxiety. They, of course, blame progesterone. And I think that part of the problem is definitely it boosts metabolism. And so you need fuel for that boost in metabolism. So if you're not eating enough, you can have an adrenaline surge. There's that. There's also what you just mentioned, which is probably thyroid is being produced. And now your body's aware of that. Massive amount, especially women like myself who have lived on adrenaline their whole lives, who are adrenaline junkies to some degree. And then they've got all this adrenaline. I mean, it's, just as an example, sometimes if I have coffee, I feel completely, like I'm going mad. Like my vision changes and I just feel like out of body. And I think that a lot of women in the group can relate to this kind of, not just with coffee, but with adrenaline and anxiety. And I don't know, I want to encourage them to not be so quick to blame the progesterone, and more to consider what you're talking about is that you're not just trying to fix your progesterone deficient state. You're trying to fix your paradoxically low energy state that you've had your whole life. And so it's going to take some time to do that, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, a lot of women want to take progesterone, obviously, for PMS, and we just talked about.
Or PMDD, which
people. PMDD, yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, PCOS. And I believe want to take progesterone for PCOS is they think PCOS in a woman and a girl is, you know, they're too androgenic, they're too male hormone producing. Mm-hmm. So they think, yeah, progesterone's like a female hormone, so I'm going to take it so I can, you know, feminize myself more. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at PCOS. And in my article on PCOS, it was my least practical one because it was the most, I guess, academic in the sense that it was, even in the title, a proposed root cause. And what I meant there in this article is that, similar to what we were just talking about before, when you're not producing enough energy, you know, your thyroid and liver aren't functioning well, then the other systems that produce these stress hormones, these backup hormones, go on overdrive. Well, that includes the adrenals, that includes the pituitary, the hypothalamus, right? So when you have a PCOS, to me, is you have so low energy production, and you have low thyroid production, low liver production, low ovary production. So as a result, there's low thyroid hormones, obviously, but there's also low ovarian function, so low progesterone, things like that. But to compensate for the low thyroid, obviously the adrenals start producing things like cortisol and adrenaline. But when you're producing so much cortisol, and you don't have an abundance of, you know, the anti-stress hormones like progesterone, which is the situation of PCOS, your body in a PCOS woman will rapidly increase DHEA because PCOS is a situation of high male hormones. So you're not turning into like more masculine because of this, you know, PCOS, the disease. You're increasing DHEA because DHEA is an antagonist to cortisol. Your body is trying to rectify the extreme stress with all that adrenal output by producing, like, yes, DHEA is from the adrenals, but you're producing it to counteract the negatives of the other adrenals that are being produced. And something that Georgi Dinkov has often talked about is the DHEA, the high cortisol production from the adrenals in a younger person, relatively better health than, you know, an older person, will produce a lot of DHEA as a result to kind of protect against the destructive effect of the cortisol, right? Because cortisol can break through, be bad for the bones, you know, not good for the muscles, you know, cause a lot of atrophy. And the DHEA will protect against that. DHEA will protect against that. But over time, the part of the adrenal that produces the DHEA, the protective DHEA, atrophies itself. So then you're left with a situation with the exact same amount of cortisol, but now you don't have the DHEA protecting you. But I bring this up because people think, oh, DHEA is the enemy in PCOS because it's more masculine than feminine, I guess. And DHEA can be turned to testosterone, and you have the chin hairs and this and that, right? Hair loss and stuff like that is all symptoms of PCOS, and people think it's because they're turning like masculine kind of thing. But the idea is the DHEA and the resulting testosterone are there because you're running on these systems that use so much of the adrenal and pituitary hormones, like the prolactin from the pituitary, the adrenaline, cortisol from the adrenals. So the big solution of PCOS is the same solution as insomnia, or the same solution as ADHD. It's to increase the energy production again, get to a better metabolic state. Because if your thyroid, liver, and ovaries are working very well, or at least as they should, the adrenals and pituitary don't have to be overcompensating for anything. They can just be normal. Normal adrenaline, normal cortisol, normal prolactin, thyroid stimulating hormone, whatever. They don't have to be excessive. And if there's not an excessive amount of adrenal output, there won't be an excessive amount of DHEA and testosterone. Those are just a result of the extreme adrenal output that is what PCOS is about. So the overall solution isn't to try to shut down the DHEA production and things like that. You don't want the DHEA to rise as a result of the high adrenal output. And progesterone can certainly help with PCOS, but it's not helping because you're, adding more feminine hormones to a more masculine hormone, producing body. No, the progesterone is helping to help promote the ovaries and helping with the thyroid and giving yourself actual progesterone so you can directly stop the need to make so much adrenal hormones. So the progesterone, in conclusion, is very good for PCOS and PMS and all these things, but it's not, it's not because you're attacking the DHEA. The DHEA is there as a result of the, extreme low stress, low energy, high stress situation the body's running in. And mm-hmm. I like PCOS as a thing to talk about because, that's, in my mind, that's the extreme thing that happens to a young woman when the systems are out of whack. But so many other things can happen that are PCOS-like. Mm-hmm. And I think just anything with low energy production, basically.
Well, if you follow that young woman into perimenopause and menopause, she's going to have exactly what you described, which is that DHEA output is gonna bottom out and the cortisol is going to stay elevated. And then she won't be able to clear her spent cortisol. And so she'll have high 24-hour free cortisol, low metabolized cortisol, but her high cortisol pattern it'll still be elevated. And that is a hypothyroid state. That is definitely ongoing hypothyroid state. But it's tough because someone who's been adrenalized their whole life, someone who's been running on adrenaline and all their stress hormones, you can say to them, all right, you have to manage your stress. You have to do breath work. You have to support adrenal function and do adrenal cocktails. You have to support your liver function and your kidney health because your adrenals sit on top of your kidneys and they work together. But really, how can you help someone now you've talked about this in your articles, but let's just use me because I'm a good example. I did all these labs. I'm so impressed because, I got off of hormones, which isn't the same thing as me getting off of my supplements, which was a few months back. This is me getting off of all the hormones that I was on. So progesterone and DHEA, a little bit of DHEA, and I was taking two different types of progesterone, got off the hormones. And then I'm on Kitty Bloomfield's program. So I was working out, doing the pro metabolic lifestyle that you encourage. And I was working out heavy weights 3 days a week, or I am doing that. And then I was counting my macros. I'm counting my macros and I'm watching what I'm eating and being really specific in that area, walking 3 to 6 miles a day. And I get my labs back, and I even remember when I did them, I was doing everything. I was taking L-theanine, I was taking glycine, I was taking all the things to mellow myself out, CBD, everything. I was the most stressed. I had zero stress in my life at that time. And I took my samples for the cortisol checking. There's four samples that I took. And I couldn't have been more on point with everything that I did, just trying to have a normal, natural, calm down life. And I get the results from the Dutch and everything looked great. I'm starting to make hormones again on my own, which is great because I'm in menopause. Everything looks better than it ever has. The problem, my cortisol was crazy. DHEA almost gone. Metabolized cortisol. I can't remember what that was. I think it was high. No, it was low, and my 24-hour cortisol was very high. So classic hypothyroid still, and totally like elevated spike in cortisol from before I wake up until midday, and then it normalizes. And that's how it's all the Dutches I've ever taken. So as long as I've worked with them, so I've probably taken seven Dutches, maybe more. Cortisol always that way. And I'm like, I don't know what else to do about cortisol. What do you do?
In terms of the effects of the stress hormones, there's a bunch of things someone can do to change the overall balance between stress and anti-stress in terms of like how they feel. So if someone has, anxiety or other kind of mood or behavioral or psychiatric whatever conditions or just symptoms, then yeah, things like that you can do to lower glutamate and increase GABA can help. Things that you can do like taurine and theanine and all those stuff can help. But in terms of like actual telling your body you physiologically don't need to make so much cortisol, it all goes back to the root of that is you don't want your body to feel the need to make more cortisol or adrenaline than necessary. And that's going to ultimately only happen when, you're producing enough of these thyroid hormones, you're converting them well, you have a good blood sugar regulation, which depends on thyroid function and metabolism, and you're using the glucose and the other, fuel substrates well, and you're making, okay. If you want your body to realize they don't need to make, it doesn't need to make so much of these stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline and other catecholamines as well, the pituitary hormones as well. It's not just the adrenal ones. You do need to be in a situation where your body doesn't feel they need to do that. So cortisol, like we were talking about the PCOS, cortisol and all these other ones, they go up when the energy production isn't optimal, when there's not enough thyroid hormone and conversion going on, when the body temperature isn't perfect, when the pulse rate isn't good. Like the body can tell with lots of different ways that the energy production is not there. The main kind of immediate, reason that cortisol or adrenaline would go up is when you're not able to make enough energy from like glucose, for example. So when the blood glucose goes low, cortisol and adrenaline increase. And adrenaline, part of what adrenaline is doing is it's releasing fat. So you have free fatty acids in the blood that can be used. Beta oxidation, they call it, because it's secondary, right? So you're oxidizing fat oxidation. But that too much of that causes a bunch of problems. But anyway, the point is adrenaline is going to increase because the blood glucose is low. Cortisol, same thing, but cortisol is actually helping you release more glucose via many different ways. They're needed for the stressful creation of glucose in the liver and stuff too, gluconeogenesis. So these stress hormones, they increase for a bunch of different ways, but the overall best root cause approach would be doing things that get your energy production and your metabolic rate at a good level, because then the body will realize it doesn't need to produce that much. So that's like the general overview. The practical way to do that would be, out of all the things that you're doing to make sure that you can tell that the metabolic rate and the metabolic state of the body is improving. So, for example, you want to regularly check total cholesterol in the blood, LDL cholesterol, right, which makes up a big chunk of the calculation of what is total cholesterol, is going to be higher in a hypothyroid state typically, right? There's other reasons LDL can be high, like endotoxin and things like that. But if LDL is high, if total cholesterol is higher than it should be, that's a good, test to see if thyroid isn't working, if your T3 isn't at a good level. So that's a good test to check often, maybe every, 4 to 6 months or something. And if your stuff you're doing, so your diet and your lifestyle, like you were saying, you're doing all these different things, if it's working, the cholesterol you would imagine would start getting to a lower level, not dangerous low, but if you're high, you should be getting to a less high level.
Yeah.
That's one thing. You want to be checking things like other blood tests, like TSH, right? If TSH is, above 2 for a while and it's not getting lower, your body is still telling you we want more thyroid hormone because it's the thyroid stimulating hormone, right? TSH, if it's higher, can indicate to you that the body still thinks there is more, there is a need for more thyroid level. There is a need for a better metabolic rate for more energy production, even if it's like above 1, 1.5 or something. It's better than being above 2, but ideally it would be a level lower than 1. And that's not a general rule because low TSH doesn't mean things are good, but it can. So if it was high, like 4, and it's getting closer to like 1.5 or something, the TSH, that's a good sign as well. Things like reverse T3 are important because if your cortisol's truly high for a long period of time, like on average, cortisol's too high, reverse T3 should increase because reverse T3, I think, does get increased by cortisol. And reverse T3, you can think of it as just basically, for all intents and purposes, like the opposite of T3. It can take the place of T3 at different areas, and then if it's taken the place of T3, T3 can't go there and do what it needs to do for the different cells and whatnot. So high reverse T3, also a bad sign. All of these are blood tests. But then in terms of symptoms and stuff, if you find yourself getting sick often, so that can be like cold, flu, chronic ear or sinus infections, being sick often is a could be a classic sign of, your thyroid hormone isn't optimal. So if you're doing things to improve your metabolism and your thyroid function and all that, but you're still, every 2 months getting like really sick, whereas other people might get only sick, once a year or something, that's not a good sign. You want to be getting sick less often. That's one example. Your bowels should be good. You shouldn't be constipated and you shouldn't have diarrhea and you shouldn't be bloated after eating. You should have really good sleep, right? You shouldn't, like, because that's the whole point, right? High energy production. You should sleep well and not be hyperactive like with ADHD. But if you still have insomnia and that's not really budging, that could be an indication that what you're doing isn't kind of working. And then, of course, the classic body temperature and pulse, that kind of stuff. And there's a ton of other tests, but all this was to say, whatever you're doing, it has to be, in some sense, unique to you. Like, there's some things that should work for the average general, person when they're trying to improve their energy production and their metabolic rate and things like that. But the only way to tell if what you're doing is working is to take note of all these different things. And, it doesn't have to be an incessant, constant thing. But if nothing's changing, if you're still sick every 2 months, and if you're always cold with your hands and feet, if your cholesterol doesn't budge, something's blocking that.
Yeah.
And
I think also what you're saying without saying it is that, I've been this way, and a lot of these women have been this way for so many years. And 16 weeks of focusing on these things that I've never focused on with this type of consistency and getting these changes already is pretty impressive. I can't expect my entire metabolic profile to be completely different and totally optimum in 16 weeks, right?
exactly.
So that's one of them. I will say I've had cholesterol levels my whole life that were enough to scare every doctor I've ever had. Like, I've had to have echocardiograms after getting my blood labs because they're like, "Oh my God, your cholesterol is so bad." I mean, really bad, like over, like close to 400 bad. And I have never been able to address this, Something that has changed has been, my cholesterol came down. It's still scary, but it's like that is a shocker. And I didn't take any statins. I didn't stop eating fat. I didn't stop eating eggs and meat, right? All the myths. I didn't do, all I did was start lifting weights and start counting my macros. And so those things are big. So maybe, so then there's another component here that could be the fact that what I just said, 16 weeks is not going to change 53 years of how I've been in just 16 weeks. But the other thing is, you know, this low-grade infection component, you know, women that have EBV, women that have herpes, women that have Lyme, women that have and co-infections and mold and all these things, you know, and that is probably playing into this, you know, high cortisol also.
You're in an alarmed state because you're, even if the infection is low grade, you still have low grade infection symptoms, right? You're increasing things like catecholamines and other stress-like things. It doesn't all, you know, adrenaline and cortisol are common stress hormones, right? But there's catecholamines and things that are hormone-like and, you know, they're stressful and they're, you know, or even prostaglandins and leukotrienes, which aren't necessarily, you know, stress hormones, but they're hormone-like compounds that are needed to fight infections and things. But, you know, the negative effects of the prostaglandins and leukotrienes, like we talked about in the last episode, asthma, MS, ALS, dementia, you know, PMS, these all have either high prostaglandins or leukotrienes, right? And if you have an infection that's not going away, you're in a chronic state of, you know, alarm and stress because there's an infection that needs to be dealt with, right? And, you know, some people, you know, over time leads to kind of autoimmune things.
Right, like women with chronic fatigue syndrome and MS and lupus and all of these inflammatory and autoimmune conditions, they're going to keep us in demand of cortisol. So, you know, just, but you were saying about the catecholamines, you know, coming in, or the DHEA coming into battle kind of to manage the adrenal output. But so is cortisol, isn't it? Cortisol is not coming in to kill us. Cortisol is a life-saving hormone that's coming in to help reduce inflammation and manage blood sugar and try to help our bodies in a stressed state. So it's also doing something that is trying to help us. But it's just like, it's like in overdrive in so many of us.
There's an overcompensation of the stress when, like what we were saying at the beginning of the episode, when the energy's low and you're, you know, let's just say compensating for that low energy production with, let's say, cortisol and adrenaline, that's good, right? But it's also, they start to overcompensate too. And the overcompensation is really harmful, but both of them are needed. Yeah, like you were saying, cortisol with the blood sugar regulation and the anti-inflammatory effects, right, are very potent. Adrenaline, if it didn't increase so much as a result of the really low energy state, you'd probably be a normal person that, you know, this is happening to, would probably be in a catatonic state or something like that, right? So, you know, you need the adrenaline, the cortisol, and the prolactin, all these things. No one wants high parathyroid hormone. It's going to lead to osteoporosis at some point, if it's left high. Georgie has written that high parathyroid hormone is linked to bipolar disorder. There's a lot of issues with parathyroid hormone as an example, but when you need calcium in certain places and you're not consuming it, parathyroid hormone is saving your life because it will release the calcium. Similarly with the cortisol and the adrenaline, and you're right, cortisol is very high in certain infection states, especially autoimmune, because it does have a lot of these effects like anti-inflammatory and things. But we want to make sure we're in a situation where we're not chronically using these things, especially overcompensating, like with the adrenaline 40 times normal. We're not just using adrenaline now it's being, you know, I don't want to say abused, but I mean,
it's a,
you know,
saturation. It's like a saturation point.
It's really an overcompensation. It's a course correction that's, you know, the body is trying to figure things out, but it's just going on overdrive. And yeah, you're right. Things like having these chronic infections, as an example, can be a huge impediment to getting to a situation where you don't have all these stress hormones. But the general goal is still always the same. And that is get your body in a position, however you can, and that could be different for different people, to not feel the need for so much hormone, so much stress hormones and stuff. So if you, let's say it's going to be really hard, if not impossible, to get rid of certain of these mild, you know, these chronic infection, low grade, then, you know, if that's always going to be there and you're always going to have a stress response as a result of that, and there, let's just say there's little you can do. I'm not saying there is, but let's just say there's little you can do. Then focusing on other aspects to lower other stress heavy activities. So doing things in your life where you don't, your body doesn't need the high cortisol and adrenaline as a response that you can control would mm-hmm. just be the thing to do. And mm-hmm. And Ray's, you know, advice seemed to always be, and what Ray wrote about always seemed to be, you know, since there's so many different, you know, factors and things that one has to do, other than eating a good diet, which, you know, is a really huge topic, because that, what does that mean? And a lot of people disagree, but in Ray Pete's mind, what a good diet was and what avoiding the bad kind of things was can take you really far. But he also often recommended taking thyroid hormones and stuff. And I'm just using that to illustrate the point that, like, he would talk about, and other people would talk about, all these illnesses, disease states, symptoms going away with the use of thyroid hormone. And that's just to illustrate the point we can glean from that, where if you're in a state where you have enough thyroid hormones and the metabolic rate's good, then these issues start dissipating. The adrenaline starts going down to normal. The cortisol starts going down to normal. You see the PCOS normalizing, the hypertension and the hyper, you know, cholesterolemia, like high cholesterol. We see, no matter what kind of illness, insomnia, ADHD, like, the idea was, that's why these are all low energy states. When you increase the energy production, any named condition, it seems, is going to improve, if not get totally better. So I'm not saying to take thyroid hormone to the listeners, but I am saying you can take this idea that supplementing the thyroid hormones, improving all these different conditions, is illustrating the idea that increasing the energy level, the energy production, thyroid level, metabolism, is going to lead to basically a benefit to all these different issues. So now the question is just, how am I going to do that? One way is obviously via taking the thyroid hormone, but another way is, you know, well, that's the point. There's lots of other ways to do it, right? And yeah, it just depends on the person's situation, their context around what their issues are, and then you got to take it from there. And there's a lot of, like we said, there's general things that are going to benefit pretty much everyone. Like, for example, consuming enough selenium is an important thing that every person needs to do, but you don't have to go about that the same way. Like, a lot of people can get enough selenium via making sure they eat enough eggs in their diet, and that's great. But some people might either not be able to eat eggs, or they can't eat eggs, or they have a lot of issues with them. Okay, then they have to find a different selenium source, which could be like shrimp or something. Or maybe some people decide that's a nutrient they're going to supplement or something. So the point is, you know, and that's just to illustrate the example that there isn't like a diet or, you know, a step-by-step thing to do to fix the energy thyroid levels so you can get all the benefits of having the lower adrenaline and stuff and getting rid of the hypertension and the insomnia and the ADHD and the et cetera, the PMS. But the more you learn about what's needed to have good energy production and good thyroid levels and things, the more you could foster and create your own kind of plan on what to do. So the selenium is one example. You know you need to eat selenium. You got to find out what foods are high in selenium, what foods you can stomach, and then you got to incorporate them. That's same with pretty much every nutrient. And it can get tedious if you're thinking of it that way. So that might not be the way for everyone, right? That's like, oh, I'm going to take every single nutrient I need and find which food is high in it. Like, you don't have to do that. But over time, figure out which foods are really nutritious and digest well and don't really have negative attributes to them, mm-hmm. relatively speaking. That's one way where you can generally say, okay, well, out of all these good kind of nutritious foods, I can eat the eggs and the steak and this and that fruit. Okay, now you're, you know, that's a basic level, but you're getting towards what you need to do to get into this good high energy state so you can get rid of all these issues that are exacerbated or even caused by the low energy state. But I know that's not a great practical thing for a listener, because they, you know,
yeah, because everyone wants a step by step. But I think it's a general good overview of I think people should avoid the do this diet, you know, do this one way thing. Trust me, it's a keto, do it, you know, like I think people should avoid that kind of concept and eliminating entire food groups and stuff like that. I think it's really more about understand how our bodies work, what metabolism is, and how to make energy and go from there. One thing that you thought you made me think of when you were talking about low-grade infection is a lot of people, including myself, always with infections have these ideas like, well, I have infections, so I've got co-infections, and they almost exclude themselves from, well, that's not going to work for me because I have infections. And that's kind of what I did a lot. You know, I was like, oh, this is going to be harder for me because of these things. And I think that now that I know, and I'm doing this plan and being consistent with everything, because I've done everything, right? I've done all the diets, all the foods, all the supplements, and nothing really has been this dramatic in watching the actual labs shift. And that is that one of the most amazing things our bodies do is fight infection. That is part of the most tremendous aspect and divine aspect of our bodies is our immune system. And so we don't have to be like, well, I have Lyme with co-infections and I've got herpes and I've got EBV, I've got chronic fatigue syndrome, I've got it all these different things. So, well, that's okay, because if you give your body what it needs to make the energy that you're talking about, one of its jobs with the right amount of energy is to fight these infections. It may not completely get rid of them. That's debatable, depends on what expert you speak to. But I know a lot of people who have had Lyme and lupus and MS. I mean, I know people who had lesions on their brain with MS and then they didn't. So I think that if you put yourself into the right state of the production of energy that your body needs in the right ratios that your body needs, because, you know, your macro count, your intake of fat, protein, and carbohydrates is going to be different than mine. But when you find out, and that's something that I learned that was tremendous in this group, this 16 weeks, is that, oh, I actually need a little more carbohydrate, this type of carbohydrate, and less fat and a little more protein than, you know, than the ideal ratio. And I found that out because I had to count my macros every day and I had to figure out what was making me feel good and bad and what gave me more energy and whatever, and what was putting on more weight. And so I think that is what you said was general and can, for some people who just want it done for them, can feel defeating and daunting. But I think it's also pointing out how important it is that we have to learn what metabolism is and how to support it in our bodies, and B, learn what that means for you. If you've got infections, if you've got, like with me, all these years of having adrenaline dominance, you know, what that means for me and how I should act accordingly based on that. I mean, look, we're going to check back in 16 more weeks and see what my cortisol is doing. And I have a feeling that if I keep up with this whole program, we're going to see even more dramatic changes, right? Because 16 weeks is not that long.
Yeah. And with the infections, that's a great example, especially infections and autoimmune things, because you're right. If you get your body in a optimum position, by that, I mean, usually an optimum position is a position where you're making the optimal amount of energy. Like you said, it's debatable if we can get rid of the infection or not, but the best chance is when you're making enough energy, because first of all, if you're not making energy well, things aren't going well, you need to, like we talked about, cortisol will have to break down tissue to get amino acids. You can deaminate them, which is basically you get glucose and ammonia, which is really bad for lots of things, including, you know, mood and brain. It's not good for dementia or anything like that. But anyway, the point is ammonia and glucose is a result of getting energy from amino acids via cortisol. And then a major area that cortisol, let's say, reduces in the body is the thymus gland. And when there is high stress, cortisol, adrenaline, when there's, the diet isn't good and the energy production isn't optimal, the thymus gland can majorly atrophy. And Ray Peter wrote a lot about that, especially in his earlier stuff. And that was part of the reason why he was really, that was one of the reasons why he was suggesting progesterone for people that have immune issues, because progesterone is one of the few things that have been found to actually help rebuild an atrophied thymus gland, right? So if you're this, you can look at it two different ways, right? Because it's, if you have this low energy production, low, which results in high cortisol and adrenaline, yeah, the cortisol and adrenaline might be high because of the infection, but the cortisol and adrenaline, and especially the cortisol, let's say, are going to prolong the infection and make it harder to get rid of the infection, because the thymus gland is the main immune system gland. That's the one that makes the white blood cells and things like that. And even talking about immune system, increasing the immune system in different ways. Like, for example, selenium is found to help with certain autoimmune disorders. And yeah, maybe that's because selenium is needed for thyroid conversion, T4 to T3, but selenium is also needed for the immune system. So progesterone, which helps the thymus gland, selenium, which is a nutrient important for, like we just said, immune system, and keeping cortisol and stuff down to protect the thymus gland. These are all different avenues of strengthening or at least preventing the weakening of the immune system, which can maybe help someone like you that's dealing with these chronic kind of low grade or, sometimes high grade infections. So, and it's just another example of where we need to make more of this energy. We need to be in a good state, and it shows the double-edged sword of the cortisol. The cortisol's helping the state that is, a result of the infection, but cortisol is leading to a worse outcome because, you don't have the guys, the white blood cells and the different phagocytes and stuff to fight the infection. So, it's very cool, because I like, that's why that's, and I think that's part of why Danny Roddy really clinged on and were, so inspired by just what Ray Peet was writing about more than anyone else. Not because Ray Peet was like saying the most interesting things that everyone. And Danny keeps coming back to the idea that Ray has a paradigm. He has a focus on a general overarching idea that you can kind of talk about. Anything we're talking about health related, body related, can be explained and looked through this lens of energy production and, energy and structure being interdependent, all these things. Everyone says magnesium is good, right? Be like, oh, magnesium is great. Look at all these different things. And that's great. But there's no way to build a health paradigm and basis from just trying to find what's good and what's bad and just kind of putting. Well, you need an idea of what this is all about, and great idea of with energy and all this, and it goes much deeper than that. But in general, I think it's fair to say Ray's kind of health paradigm was pretty close to the idea that optimal energy production is necessary to have good health with any aspect. Because if someone asks me, oh, what to do about high cholesterol, or what to do about blood pressure or schizophrenia, or random, totally unrelated things seemingly, I'm pretty sure he would almost always want the person to understand that you can take all the supplements or drugs or do the things for your named condition, right? The schizophrenia or the autism or the, hypertension, whatever, but seemingly totally unrelated, but I'm pretty sure he would always want the person to realize, if you go back to the basics, if you're not producing enough energy, your thyroid, and he would always talk about thyroid, the thyroid levels aren't optimal, which is synonymous with saying the energy is not optimal, the ATP is not optimal, whatever, you're gonna run into problems. And you're kind of, it's like a dog chasing his tail kind of thing. That's what I think about when you're just trying to find, wow, spirulina is so great, or wow, turmeric is so great. You're just taking random things that are supposed to be good, and you're trying to find out why they're good or whatever. But if you're just grabbing at random things, there's no health basis. There's no basis for how to deal with different, the health issues. And that's why race so great, in my opinion. I think I have the same kind of idea as others that really like Ray, because what he's talked about and what I've learned about from him has made it easier to look at any named health condition. I feel confidence in learning about it and learning what possible things someone can do to rectify the situation, because I have like a basis of what the body needs to be doing, right? So any named health condition, and I can research and, you know, find a way to at least try to ameliorate some of the issues with it. And that's, I have the confidence to do that because of the Ray books and writings and things he said. It's not just that, you know, any condition you can go and try to, you know, search different things. You need to have the basis of understanding what's going on. So, yeah.
You know, for my little brain, I like to put everything into an analogy, and it's like a car. It's like you look at a car and you go, what is the function of a car? It is to run and get you from point A to point B. So when something goes wrong with the car, like it's not starting well, or it's slowing down or whatever, you know, you can say, oh, the tires look low. The windows need to be washed. The upholstery looks torn and ripped. The car smells funny inside. But ultimately, what makes that car go is the engine. Okay, so let's figure out what's going on with the engine. Does it have fuel in it? Yes, it has fuel. How are the filters? Is it detoxing well? Are the filters clean? Does it have oil? Does it have lubrication? Does it have, what's the carburetor doing? How are the spark plugs? How, that's the engine. That the paradigm of that vehicle is that it runs on energy. And if it's not utilizing its fuel properly or getting the proper fuel, it's not going to get you from point A to point B. It doesn't matter what color the car is, or if you washed it today, or if you gave it turmeric, or if you gave it this or that. We need to figure out, why isn't it running smoothly? So if you look at it from the lens of, it's a car, it needs to get fuel, it needs to clear the exhaust from that fuel, from that vehicle. Is it doing those things right? And then check the tires, and then check the paint, and check the windows and the windshield wipers, right? So for us, it's like, yeah, we can go ahead and address, look at the belly fat. Oh my God, I don't fit into my jeans. We can look at my skin and say, let's put topical skin cream. I want to use this kind of shampoo. Let's get rid of, you know, but ultimately, am I getting enough fuel, and am I digesting it and absorbing that fuel? And am I clearing the exhaust from that fuel, from my bowels and my liver and my kidneys and my detox organs? Is that happening optimally? Is my metabolism making energy and making my car go from point A to point B? And if you can throw all the things you want at it, and you can say, look at all the diseases you want, but ultimately diabetes, Alzheimer's, autism, all the things you mentioned, it's going to come down to, are you getting enough fuel? What kind of fuel is it? What kind of quality of fuel is it? Are you absorbing? Are you digesting that fuel? Are you absorbing that fuel? What's happening with that fuel in your gut? Is it getting cleared and detoxed through all your detox organs properly, right? That's ultimately the paradigm that Ray Pete gives us. He does not tell you what kind of car to buy. He doesn't tell you what kind of fuel to put in your car. He doesn't tell you how to get rid of the fuel or clear the exhaust or what kind of filters to buy or what kind of car to buy. He just says, you've got a car and it needs these things to run. And how that works for you is going to be different than how it works for me. So go run with that, right?
Yeah, like exactly. One example that maybe a lot of your listeners haven't heard, you know, It's not a popular or talked about health metric or something that we should look to do in the diet. But Ray often talked about the importance of the calcium to phosphorus ratio, right? But in Ray, after discussing why it's important to make sure that you have balanced calcium to phosphorus in the diet, so you don't have way more phosphorus than calcium, that kind of thing. That's pretty much as far as it goes in terms of a recommendation. He himself liked to make sure his calcium to phosphorus ratio was balanced by consuming a lot of dairy, cheese, and milk and stuff. But, you know, you don't have to be healthy in terms of, you know, Ray Pete. What would Ray Pete say? You know, he's not going to tell you you have to have milk and cheese to be healthy, but I'm pretty sure he would have believed that he would have had the opinion that, well, if your calcium to phosphorus ratio in the diet is suboptimal, you will have problems. So now it's up to you, the individual to say, well, everything is phosphorus in it, grains, beans, meat, fish. Phosphorus is very plenty, right? And if you want to have at least a 1-to-1 ratio of calcium to phosphorus, or even ideally like 2-to-1, you're going to have to say, okay, now I have to figure out where I'm going to get the calcium. And certain ways, maybe if you need to, if you're eating a lot of phosphorus foods, maybe a way to kind of reduce some of the phosphorus in the diet, right? But this is just a really specific random example just to show that exactly what you said, like you're not going to have, and you shouldn't find something that's as specific as to be healthy, you need to have, like, you need to eat, you know, this amount of cheese every day or whatever. But it is good to have different general goals, such as this calcium to phosphorus balance I was talking about. You have to figure out yourself how you're going to solve it. And like we talked about in a very long, very episode long ago, I can't have, you know, dairy, unfortunate, but I still have to figure out how to get the calcium in, because you can't just not allow the calcium to phosphorus ratio to be, you know, good, or you can't just have zero calcium in the diet. So that's something I have to figure out. If you're lactose intolerant, so you can have dairy, maybe figure out taking the lactase pills in the meantime, but try to figure out how to get rid of the lactose intolerance. Ray talked about, he thinks progesterone improving thyroid function would improve a lactose intolerance state. Run with those ideas. Find out more. He's obviously talked about lactose intolerance more, but, you know, run with that, you know. But yeah, so it's the same idea. You do want, if you're new to this, it's going to be daunting, but
yeah,
the only way to do it is you got to spend the time to read and or at least listen. And then you'll slowly put the pieces together, but there's never going to be, even with my articles, I try to give knowledgeable yet practical advice in every different kind of condition. But, you know, you can read all of the current 20 and you'll still probably be confused if you don't do your own reading and listening and research on these topics. Because once you have the general pieces, like maybe you never heard of the calcium thing before, okay, now you've heard it. There's a lot of things like that you need to, that people need to learn and understand. But once you have these general bases, then you keep tweaking and personalizing and individualizing, and then hopefully at some point with all this understanding and you know what to do, you can make your own plan.
Yeah.
That's the goal, I guess.
Well, I think that there's going to be people who just, it doesn't work for, because they need more handholding. They want to be told exactly what to do. I'm trying to come up with a concept now, just working on some projects where I can incorporate, yeah, like a food list and some meal plans and some recipes, so people can actually have something to hang their hat on in a way. They can be like, okay, I feel comfortable with this. But it just like Kate Deering's book, you know, it's incredibly informative, but those foods may not work for you. And so you have to figure it out, right? So no matter what the book is, you're going to find things that are just not going to work for you. But I wanted to just mention something really obvious, but cool, which is going back to what you said about infections. And, you know, if you have these infections, well, think about when people have flare-ups or outbreaks or episodes of their EBV or MS or herpes or whatever. When is it? And we always say this, you say it and you don't even realize you say it. Someone goes, oh, why did you get sick? Or what happened? Why do you think you got this or whatever? And you say, because I've been run down, right? I've been stressed. I've been run down. And that's when I always get my whatever. And what does run down mean? It means a state of low energy, right? You're run down. You're exhausted. You're stressed. You're tired. You just are over it. Your body's done. It's run down. Out of energy. And then these pathogens find the opportunity to not have to deal with your thymus gland and your immunity. And they go to town, right? And they take over. They're like, oh, cool. Daddy's taking a nap. Let's take over. And then you have an outbreak, yep, or a flare-up. So I wanted to ask you quickly about the thymus gland. I heard that the thymus stops growing when you're like a baby. Like it's like after like 2 years old or something, it's just like, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't stop functioning, right? It functions till you're like 75 or something, right?
So what I've read is that like it can be built up by some stuff and it can be brought down by other things. Like cortisol can, by breaking it down for the amino acids and stuff. Well, okay, first of all, I've read that stress itself, having a, you know, a lot of stressful situations, since the immune system isn't a immediate priority when there's a lot of, you know, immediate issues at hand, so situations where there'll be a lot of stress hormones as a result, the immune system isn't as important. So things will happen that when the immune system will kind of almost be, you know, suppressed or lowered, and the thymus gland can shrink. Because, you know, immune system is a long-term strategy, but it's not gonna, you know, it's not the reason you're living in this very second, but you want a strong immune system so you don't die in the future, kind of thing. So I've always had, you know, I've read that, you know, the thymus will shrink, but it will also grow. And things like, you know, Ray has written that progesterone will help kind of rebuild a shrunken or atrophied thymus gland.
This says the Cleveland Clinic, whatever, however you feel about that. It says the thymus gland is most active during childhood. Your thymus actually starts making T cells before you're born. It keeps producing T cells and you have all the T cells you need by the time you reach puberty. After puberty, your thymus gland slowly starts to decrease in size and is replaced by fat.
Yeah, like Ray didn't write that. So they're, you know, at odds with each other, right? And
but then in this other study, which is PubMed, it says that it thymus regeneration and the capacity to self-regenerate itself. And that's an actual PubMed study, and that it is possible and that it can continue to work up until your 70s. So,
well, I think it does work. It should work past 70s too, though. I mean, it's what makes the immune cells. I think it's just a gland like the other ones. And there's things that can weaken it, shrink it, make it atrophy. And there's things that can grow. And Ray was showing evidence that progesterone can help strengthen and rebuild it. And things like cortisol are known to shrink and kind of shred it down. So I think it is something where, it, you know, you can have a stronger immune system, weaker immune system, and they can, you know, you're not destined. Once you have a weak immune system, it's not like you can't grow back, and you can't. And just because you have a good thymus doesn't mean it can't shrink. It's I think it goes up and down. That's the impression I have based on the immune system research, even with like selenium and stuff, like, you know, different things help improve immune system. It's not that you have an immune system as a child and it just gets kind of weaker. That's not the impression I have.
Okay. Anything else that you wanted to talk about before we wrap up?
Yeah, I guess I want to quickly, briefly, since we talked about energy a lot, and a lot of the times you talk about energy, we just talked about good thyroid hormone levels and function, and, you know, it was all very general and on the surface. But one thing I want to quickly say, just for the listener that might be thinking a lot about how to improve energy, one major thing to know is that when you need to use glucose well, you need to oxidize glucose, utilize it well. And this can be a result, you know, not using glucose well can be a big issue, because if you're not using glucose well, you're not making enough energy. Obviously, you have all these things we talked about that come as a result of low energy production, so that's not good. But also, just more specifically, more directly, if you can't use glucose well, then you will feel bad eating carbohydrates. So if you're someone that, you know, doesn't do well on, you know, potatoes and fruit and honey and, you know, rice or whatever, and you think, well, carbs are just not for me, carbs are for everyone, right? So that no one is someone that is, you know, oh, carbs are just not for me. That's not true. But depending on your, a lot of things, let's just say health level, it can be very hard for you to actually use the carbs. So obviously, if someone can't use carbs well, they'd feel better just not eating them. And that's fine. I understand that logic, but no one is, oh, I'm just someone that can't have carbs. Maybe right now, but that's not who you are. So the point is, you might be asking, okay, well, if I can't use glucose, well, like, how do I use it better? And classic example of this is, other than just not feeling well after eating something with glucose, like a potato, maybe your blood glucose is very high, your hemoglobin A1C is high on a blood test, and your doctor's telling you, oh, your blood sugar is bad, it's high. They might want you to be on metformin or something. Well, the idea is, if you can't take the glucose from the blood and do stuff with it, oxidize it, turn the glucose, run it through the different enzymes, the different complexes in order to get to the eventual ATP, water, heat, all those things, carbon dioxide, then yeah, the glucose is going to stay in the blood. It's going to stay high, and you will be diagnosed with insulin resistance or prediabetes or eventually diabetes. And if you actually have these conditions, diabetes, it could eventually turn into diabetes type 3, which is basically, in general, dementia, right? Alzheimer's, all the other kind of dementias. So obviously, it's important to be able to use glucose well. And at a very basic level, obviously, thyroid is very important. T3 is important. So everything we talked about before about having good thyroid function and liver and all those are important. But at a more kind of nutrition level, to use the glucose that's in the blood well, you do need adequate amounts of vitamin B1 and magnesium for a very specific enzyme. I won't get into the details, but it's pyruvate dehydrogenase, PDH it's called. But anyway, you need enough of those too. So you need to get them in your diet, and you need to avoid things that deplete them. So, for example, if you're having alcohol daily, I mean, alcohol does kind of, there's studies of people that are having like a dementia-like state because of chronic alcoholism, which has depleted the B1 levels dramatically. One of the things that are given to you when you're kind of in a drunk tank is a solution that has B vitamins, including B1. Like, that's the point, is alcohol and vitamin B1 are, they're not friends. So if you're gonna have alcohol, you have to make sure, well, I need to be consuming more B1. Obviously, there's, supplementation's an option, but at the very basis, you just need to know, I need to get in enough B1 and magnesium. Okay, it doesn't matter where you get it, food, whatever. Then there's also biotin and manganese. Those are important for another glucose-using enzyme. Nutrients like chromium and potassium are very important for the utilization of glucose. Potassium is high in many foods like potatoes and tomatoes. Chromium is high in few foods, like mussels are very high in chromium and other shellfish, but also it's high in brewer's yeast and a few other foods. But do your research on finding what foods are high in chromium and potassium and stuff. I'm just giving some examples, but all these nutrients, if you're consuming enough of them or supplementing in some situations, like B1 might be a good one, you should be improving how your body can actually take the glucose and use it. Over time, consuming things like fruits or honey or potatoes, if you're having enough of these nutrients, the biotin, manganese, potassium, chromium, B1, magnesium, all the systems that need these nutrients to use the glucose should be functioning better, right? So you can kind of force yourself to use glucose well if you can't use it well by either taking or consuming more of these foods, nutrients. But that's kind of like how to use glucose well. But I'll briefly just say before we end, it's also important to not do or not be in a position where it's hard to use glucose in the first place. And a classic example of that is having a lot of fat in the blood, free fatty acids, is a major way to prevent using glucose well, because the fat in the blood will, in a way, compete with the glucose in the blood. So how do you not have a lot of fat in the blood? Well, adrenaline is the main thing that kind of releases these free fatty acids. So you want it, it always comes back to the energy. You want to be in a position where you're not producing a lot of stress hormones, a lot of adrenaline. You don't run with really low blood glucose. You're not fasting all the time, because then all that fat in the blood, free fatty acids, and the fat comes in the blood so you can use it as a fuel. But if you have too much in the blood, that competition of the glucose will cause a lot of problems. And there's a lot more to the story, and I don't want to get too detailed now because we're ending. But if you want to find more, That's my most popular article on the ConstantineK.substack.com. It's how to utilize glucose well in the free article section. You can read more about it, but there's a lot more that goes to using glucose well, and one other thing that someone might be able to take if their glucose utilization is really bad is niacinamide. That's another one. I won't explain why it helps. It'll take too long, but it's in the article. And yeah, last thing. So anyway, that's important because when you're talking about energy production, it's very important to know you got to use glucose well. Even if you're, keto or something, you're still using glucose. So you want to be using glucose well. Ideally, that's also with a diet of eating carbohydrates. But I totally agree that if you can't use glucose well, until you can, you won't be able to handle that many carbs. You still should eat carbohydrates, in my opinion, but the goal isn't to eat 300 grams of carbohydrates a day if you can't use them. You want to use them, and then you can increase the
good point.
Amount. But you should still have a good base level, even if you can't use them super well. You still, in my opinion, should be eating carbohydrates. But anyway, I just wanted to end with that because this whole episode was in a way about energy, and this is a very important aspect of how to make energy, how to utilize glucose well. And the last thing I'll say is, I mentioned a few times in this podcast, I write articles on different specific health conditions, and there's by the time this is out, there'll be 20 or 21. So I won't name them all, but you can imagine there's many, and there's many more coming, 5, 6, 7 more at this point. There might be more in the future, but the point is, whatever health condition you or your loved one has, I may have written about it or something similar. So feel free to go check it out. It's free to subscribe. You just got to put your email. Only a few articles are premium, and even the premiums are like half of it is free anyway. But most articles are totally free. The ADHD, the insomnia, like we mentioned today, PMS, all free. I really appreciate the subscribes. And also for Onus, my discount code is Dean, DEAN. Thank you.
Yeah. And we have the pregnenolone, which is the Luna Madre, and we have the progesterone and all of the strengths, the 3%, 5%, 10%, 20%, and also the Luna oil, which is 10% as well. And all of that information for his Substack is in the show notes.
Perfect. Thanks.
Okay, I told you that that was going to be great, and it always is. Constantine is just a wealth of knowledge, and I frankly think that if you do not subscribe to his premium articles, that you're crazy. I forget how much it is for the year, but it's not that much. And it's supporting him. He's working in a law firm. He's interning. He's working his butt off, and he's still helping all of us. And he's still answering questions in the group, and he's writing articles, and he wants to write a group, and he's trying to help his own family with their health issues. And I just think everybody should support him. He's so great. And he helps me. He's helped me so much through all of my stuff. And I also want to remind you that everything is changing with the Dutch. Okay. So the new program, if you want to work with me on my new website, which will be up in the next week or so, you will look for Work with Kitty on that first page of my website. And that's going to explain to you the entire gut and hormone rehab program. That'll explain absolutely everything to you and what it entails. And that's going to be in the show notes. Mighty Network is on the back burner for now. It's just requiring so much of my time, and I'm just, I don't have that time to spare. So we're sticking with the Facebook group for the moment, but we're going to start adding a lot of videos and a lot of how-tos. I'm going to start just being more proactive in the group with my physical self, showing you how to apply progesterone, where to apply it, dosing. But even though that information is there, I'm going to do it through video. So that'll be fun and different. And again, everything you need to know about Constantine and everything he mentioned is in the show notes. All right, everyone, take care. Talk to you soon. Yeah!